Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio, a public affairs program dedicated to bringing you speeches recorded from around the state, given by experts lecturing on topics from environmentalism and sustainability to the global economy, politics, and beyond. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's program was recorded recently before the USM School of Law at their fifth annual Justice for Women lecture. The speaker is Dr. Lindiwe Majele-Sibanda of Zimbabwe. She'll give a talk titled, Overcoming Food Insecurity, Ideas and Inspiration from Zimbabwe to Maine, discussing poverty, hunger, and food insecurity. Introducing Dr. Sibanda is Danielle Conway, Dean of the USM School of Law.
We are honored to expand the JFW circle tonight to include Dr. Lindiwe Majele-Sibanda. Persistent, abominable, a holocaust, and camouflaged. These are descriptions of hunger, a silent yet treacherous killer. Hunger's very close companion is food insecurity. These two states of being, hungry and food insecure, are more prevalent both globally and locally than we care to admit or could possibly fathom. While Dr. Sibanda will give us a global perspective on food insecurity, we must recognize that food insecurity has reached epidemic proportion right here in Maine. First, let me define food insecurity. Food insecurity is the unreliable access to sufficient, affordable, nutritious food, accompanied by the reality that one does not know when or where one will get her next meal. Second, bear with me while I share some facts about food insecurity in Maine and nationally. Fact one, 5,000 households in Cumberland County alone depend on food pantries every month. Fact two, not only is Maine third in the country for hunger, people going extended periods without access to food, but Maine ranks 12th in the nation for food insecurity. Fact three, Maine ranks first in New England and 12th in the nation for the number of individuals struggling with hunger. Fact four, one of every four children in Maine experiences food insecurity. Fact five, food insecurity is the preventable precursor to hunger. That is hard to hear. As humanists, eradication of food insecurity is a social, economic, and political imperative. Because of this, Justice for Women at Maine Law has focused this week's lecture series on facilitating direct, objective information flow in and among our communities, with the expectation that our efforts will promote ongoing activism to prevent food insecurity and hunger. To inform our discussion and activism, we call on Dr. Lindiwe Majele-Sibanda. Dr. Sibanda of Zimbabwe is a global leader in the sustainable farming movement and the fight to end hunger and food insecurity. She coordinates policy research and advocacy programs aimed at making Africa a food and nutrition secure region. Dr. Sibanda is currently leading the multi-country agriculture to nutrition project aimed at addressing the question, what can agriculture do for nutrition? This project seeks to improve nutrition outcomes in smallholder farm families and poor households through tailored, nutrition-sensitive agriculture programs that ultimately benefit women of childbearing age and children in the first 1,000 days of life. Dr. Sibanda also serves as a trustee and advisor to numerous international food security-related initiatives and has been involved with the Farming First Global Campaign, advocating for a holistic approach to sustainable agricultural development since 2008. In 2013, Dr. Sibanda was recognized as one of seven women working to change the food system in honor of International Women's Day by the Food Think Tank. She also received the 2014 Farah Award and the 2013 Yara Prize Laureate in recognition of her effective entrepreneurial work and her contributions to agricultural development in Africa. More than all of these accolades, Dr. Sibanda is just, in a very few days, has captivated our community by showing us her true passion. Educating for justice. Although soft-spoken, her aura is potent and graciously authoritative. She will make you lean in. Please help me welcome Dr. Lindiwe Majele Sibanda.
My father, Johnson Majele Sibanda, was here with me, he would have said, whose child is that? My father, Majele, has no formal education. However, at the age of 82, he's now revered by his community as advisor to all who want to get into business, to all who want to get into politics. Oops. I am sorry. And he stands tall. And when I look back, I realize some of the values that he tried so hard to instill in all of us. If you talk to all men of my generation who were interested to get into his crawl, they will tell you, no wonder you girls are educated. Your father said, no college degree, no marriage. And we stuck to that. He also instilled in us values of hard work. He always said, hard work don't kill anybody. And the first job you're going to get is in the house, and when you graduate from the house, it's the farm. And nobody works outside before they get the qualifications that I'm going to give you for farming. No wonder I'm in the business of farming, now by choice. My father also instilled in all of us that every breath you take should be an opportunity to learn and an opportunity to teach. And I've just been wowed by the community that has given so much here in Maine. I've learned, and I do hope that I've been able to be true to my father's teachings and share with you what I have learned. But one thing I know for sure is that my dad got all this from his mother. She is and was the mother of all universities I've ever been to. Gogo Mayembe, as we all called her, was a giant in her community. She stood at 1.8 meters tall, taller than me. She woke up at 4 a.m. in the morning, always in prayer. And my dad loved his mom, and he says the reason why he didn't do much school is that he ran to the city to get a job so he could buy his mom a big queen-size bed that she would sleep on, and he did do that. But for me, when I reflect on Grandma's values, the way she brought us up, because without fail, we spent close to 3 months in a year helping her on her farm plot, which was just 2 acres, but it fed all of us. Every 3 months, we left the city to go during our school holidays for our second calling, which was the qualification of farming and training by Grandma. Only now I realize it was training on a job I would enjoy, and only now I realize it was to help her with the labor that she needed. But what was special in that 2 acre plot was that all our food came from that farm. It wasn't just the 5 children from my father's family. It was all the grandchildren who'd come from the city, from my grandmother's 6 children. In total, we were 18 grandchildren. And my dad will pack us at the back of his open truck, carry us to the family farm, where we spent 3 weeks of school holidays, 3 times a year. What I enjoy about those memories is that Grandma would make sure that we got food, and the feeding times were the best times. So there would be the 18 grandchildren, but there will be other cousins from the neighboring community who join us. And at any one time, we would be a homestead with over 25 people all under one roof. Food was in abundance, but there was no wastage. From the 2 acre plot, my grandmother would have sufficient corn and cornmeal that would be pounded and processed into our traditional mealie meal, which we used for breakfast porridge, for pap for lunch, and for dinner. But with every meal, in those 3 meals, there was balance. The mealie meal porridge always had some peanut butter with it. The lunch pap would always have Grandma. If it was chicken she had slaughtered, this would be the free-ranging chicken from her backyard. She would carefully break the pieces to feed all 25 of us. Of course, his favorite son got the most, but we all got a piece. And what was special with those feeding moments is that there was a feeding station for the children who are under 5. There was a feeding station for the boys who are teenage boys, because they did the cattle heading and they sat. And for us girls, there was a particular way of sitting. The right hand is what you use for eating. You use your left hand, it's tied at the back because you don't respect the food. So we had to sit on the floor with the left hand stretched out so that you lean on it, and then your feet are folded and you're literally sitting on them and you're using one hand, the right hand, to pick the food. The traditional pap meant that you pick the starch, roll it into a ball, dip it into the beans, you pick a few beans, into the spinach, and then you eat. You don't pick the meat until the eldest in your ring has started the picking. The pieces were counted. Each child would have 1 piece. When you pick your piece, you put it on your left hand. And as the meal times were shush times, you'd only take a small bite at a time, so that that 1 piece lasted the whole 20-minute period for feeding. The matron sat there, and she always sat with the feeding mothers. And at any one time, there would be one of the grandchildren who had a child who would be feeding a child of about 2 years, because they make sure that they stayed on the breast for up to 2 years. And Grandma won't be eating. She'll be watching to see who is cheating, who is picking meat first, and that the mothers would feed their children first into the mother's mouth, then the next piece is theirs. And that was to make sure that these babies were adequately fed. We enjoyed because in between we could go out and grab fruit from the garden. There was an orchard in the 2-acre plot where we had mangoes, we had oranges, we had guavas, and we had strawberries. And throughout the year, whenever we visited, there was a fruit in season. And for fruits, you didn't have to ask for permission. We said that was from God to man, so you could have it anytime. At the end of the day, when the cattle came in, where we had to put them in a crawl so that they're safe from the wild animals at night, we would go and make sure they're all encrawled. But in the process, you had to grab a cow and milk straight into your mouth. And those were wonderful times. This was warm milk from God to man. That was our lingua for stealing, because what meant is, don't ask for permission, do it fast before grandma shouts that, what about my calves? So when I think of my grandmother, those are the memories I have. We didn't even have the food just in abundance when we were at the farm. When we went back to the city, the truck would be full of loads of dried meat, bags packed with the maize meal for us to enjoy in town, fruits that we harvested, sweet potatoes, watermelons, all the bounty harvest from the family farm. And that's what kept us going in the city. Unfortunately, my grandmother died, but she died at an age of 110, and we celebrated because all of us, up to this day, 25 years later, she is the reference point for food security. The family farm was taken over by a nephew, Moses. He hadn't done much school. He's the one who wanted to continue with farming because farming had become for those who hadn't made it to the city. We had our college degrees. I'm one, the only one, I think, in the bigger family who's going to study agriculture. Part of that is because I carry the name Majele. I'm the only one, which really has its roots in that my father, when he was born, my grandmother had been put in jail because her cattle had strayed into the neighbor's field and my grandfather was nowhere to be found to pay the fine. So the name Majele in Zulu translates into a prison because that's where my dad was born. But I'm proud to carry that name because it has kept me connected to my roots and to my farming background. So Moses takes over the farm, and this is 1980 in Zimbabwe, and things are booming. The government wants to push for a green revolution. And what that means is that if you harvest your corn, you can take it to the grain marketing board, where for every ton you harvest, you are paid 150 United States dollars equivalent. So what did Moses do? He cleared the whole 2-acre farm, removed all the orchards, removed all the sweet potato patches, removed everything and dedicated the 2-acre plot to corn. He made the money because government was giving free seed, free fertilizer. If you didn't have the money, you could take an advance. As long as you deliver to the marketing authority, they would deduct for the inputs from your deliveries. The yield went up. Moses was in the 5-ton club. You can imagine, he would at some times have $1,000 in his pocket. The poverty line was a dollar a day, which is $365 a year, and Moses was making 3 times that. Life was good. We rarely visited home because grandmother was there, but Moses bought himself a cell phone, he bought himself a bicycle, and he bought himself everything that he needed. But what that meant is that they depended on the market for all the other foods. And the corn was what was available. If the wife didn't have money, it meant corn for breakfast, corn for lunch, corn for dinner, and very little in between. Well, at least they were fed. And after all, in my culture, when you talk food, you're talking staple. And the staple in Zimbabwe and most of Southern Africa is corn. So if you've got that, you're fine. You've got food. What is your problem? Even if you've only got a tablespoon of beans, that's detail. You've got food. Your tummy is full. So this went on for a good 15 years until the government stopped providing the inputs and the markets crashed. If you delivered, you didn't get your money on time. But the other change was that instead of getting free education, which I benefited from during my time, everything needed money. It was fine when Moses was in the 5-ton club, 5 tons per hectare. But now it meant he had to pay for education for his young children, he had to pay for hospital bills, and the yields had gone from 5 tons to 3 tons to 1 ton to 800 kilograms per hectare, per 2 acres. Why? Because he could no longer afford the fertilizer and the quality seeds that he was getting through the government policies. Farming was no longer fun. Moses left the farm to go and look for employment in the city. But the people in the city need education if you are going to get a job. The minimum had become college degree. And because government had expanded the number of schools, we call it the minimum level becomes college. And yet when my dad started, the minimum was if you could read and write, you could get a job to get by. So the wife remained in the farm, and she had to do all the duties and became the backbone of agriculture for the family farm. And she was not the only one. What Moses did became common in the whole village. It wasn't just for Zimbabwe. This is a virus that spread all over Africa as a result of the economic structural adjustment programs. 2011. The Green Revolution is more cereal, more fertilizer, more hybrid seed, but we are rainfall dependent. We had the worst drought in our region in 1991-92. Our ministers met and said they need to move maize, corn, from countries of plenty to countries of deficit. They sat and said, we need a think tank. That led to the organization that I work for, FANAPAN, which was really established to say, we need to harmonize our policies so that in times of drought, we can move commodities from areas of plenty, from countries that have surplus, to countries of deficit, so that we make sure we alleviate the food insecurity, but more important, people have food. And in most cases, it is just maize. We put together the network, but the clever thing that happened was that the elders who met then were sure that they needed government, private sector, research organizations, and farmers to be part of the network. What does FANPAN Network do? We carry out research that is there to inform policy so that our food security policies are evidence-based. When we've done the research, we convene dialogue platforms. And in those dialogue platforms, we make sure government is there, farmers are there, private sector, and the research community to share the evidence of what is happening in the country, what is happening in the region, and what are the policy options that will alleviate the suffering. The biggest challenge we are facing now is malnutrition. Because of our pursuit of the Green Revolution, because of our pursuit of a monoculture where maize, the corn, has become the food, we in Africa have 161 million children who are stunted. That stunting is not just the height, but it's the brain that is dwarfed. What that means is that their cognitive capacity has been compromised because they don't get sufficient food, they don't get sufficient micronutrients, Their mothers are dying during pregnancy, and if they do survive, they have anemia because of low iron. The milk, the meat is no longer available because these are assets that have been sold. The cattle have been sold to finance the health bill. The goats have been sold. The chickens have been slaughtered, and they've stopped reproducing because even the last one has been sold off to finance an urgent need. Poverty is causing the food insecurity. And when we talk poverty at FANPAN, we have measured the asset base. We've looked at the human assets. We've looked at the number of people in the household who are able to farm, who are educated and can get out and send remittances, who can acquire knowledge and use technologies to modernize their farming. We've measured the social networks that are there, the institutions that are there to support the families. We've measured the physical assets, housing, the implements for farming. We've also measured the natural assets, the acreage, the quality of the soil that these households have access to. We've also looked at remittances and financial assets and given a score to households so that we can provide interventions that are targeted. Because unless we deal with the poverty, we are going to create a society of welfare cases. We are going to create a society where we give food aid and we don't lift people out of poverty so that they can self-help. So what we have done is we give a score. We identify households that are sitting at the center of the table and can cope. We have households, because of the current drought in 2016, it's one of the worst droughts, worse than the 1991-92 drought. We have households that are falling off the table. Unless we rescue them, first with food aid, but then the assets they need to go back into productive farming, because this is the only business they know. Then we have a proportion, the third leg, of welfare cases. Those are really in an acute stage. And in most cases, food on a permanent, reliable, affordable basis is the only way. These are some of the arrangements that we've put in place as a network to help Moses, to help him go back to the business he knows most, because being in the city is not going to help him. Nobody wants to house him anymore because the income for city dwellers has gone down. But what we have to worry about is the children in the first 1,000 days. If we don't deal with the stunting, if we don't make sure that mothers are empowered with the knowledge they need and with the nutrients they need during the first 1,000 days, which is from conception to the time the child attains their second birthday, that's how we count the 1,000 days. This is the window of opportunity where we can reverse the effects of stunting or eradicate them. Any time after that, the returns are limited. This then begs the question, what type of agriculture should we be pursuing? In this era of climate change, we need to be climate smart farmers. We need to invest in irrigation so that we don't depend on rain-fed agriculture. We need to invest in research so that the seeds that we are growing are climate-proofed. They are relevant to the climate that's already changed. But more important, we need to build resilience in our communities. Climate change is a global challenge. Hunger is a global challenge. Malnutrition is a global challenge. I don't want to live in a world where 1 in 2 people will have low cognitive capacity, because I won't be able to learn and engage and do what my father said is the whole reason of breathing. You give, you take, and you are empowered, and that's what his development agenda is. surely we can do something about it. At FunPan, we speak about messengers who are equipped with research evidence. We speak about the message that is evidence-based, and we speak about dialogue platforms where we convene and use the evidence to influence policy. Speaking to Mainers, this is a platform that can make a difference. Because unless we can talk about the issues that affect us, unless we can use the evidence that we collect, we validate, and we equip the people that are affected by these policies to engage head on with the issues, with the policymakers, in a productive manner, whereby we hold our leadership to account. We follow through when they've taken a political decision. That's a line we do not cross because we've elected them into power to make those political decisions. But when they've made the political decisions, we never give up. We get our researchers to continue documenting the best practices from other countries, bringing that experience to these countries, and making sure we solve our problems. It's a global issue. Moses is waiting for answers. But one thing I know when I get home, when my father meets me and says, "What did you learn?" I will tell him, "I met President Cummings from the University of Southern Maine, who said, we used to be proud as the United States of America, as leaders in education. We have lost the race." I will tell my dad that I'm proud to have been part of the community of Maine because I met the mayor and I got the key to the city. I will tell my father that I'm proud because I was able to participate in the launch of the first food charter, a charter that speaks to safe, affordable food for all. I'm proud to be associated with people who are forward-looking and who want to cater for the world. I'll tell my dad I went to the Good Shepherd Food Bank. I learned that in times of plenty, you should be like Mainers who feed Mainers. I've learned that you should be a food bank that says no to junk food and sets a benchmark. It sets a benchmark that they will want to be 80% fresh commodity food bank. I'll tell my dad I had the opportunity to meet hunger fighters at St. Mary's Hall. They asked me difficult questions. They wanted to know, how do you avoid food losses? I had no answers. They told me they are facing challenges with transportation of commodities from and to their farms. And I said, that's exactly what we are facing and grappling with in Africa. I thought these guys had all the answers, so we are one. I'll tell my dad I met Somali Bantu community who pride in producing food for their community by farming, and they see farming as a way of exercise. They see farming as a profession that brings dignity to people, and they see farming as a way of relating to their own community as they sing along when they are working the land and carrying the produce to the market. They feel their dignity has been restored. There was, however, a difficult question, and the question was, food systems are complex. They are about culture. How do we bring respect to those we seek to help through food aid, yet we want them to appreciate that we want to meet them halfway with the right type of food that is close to their culture, but also that adds value to them and not what we don't want to use. I learned about rooftop gardening. I learned from a community of women, both at the Good Shepherd Food Bank, but also here in Maine. I picked up a new term, the New Mainers. I learned there are some champions, women New Mainers, like Fatima, who are leading in their communities, like Mufalo, who say May is our month. We are going to showcase what immigrant women can do. They are trailblazers in this community of Maine. I'm proud to have been part of that community and to have shared a meal in Betty's home, where women to women, we were able to share what it takes to be a leader, not just in the home, but in the community and in the whole of the country and the world. I'm excited with the encounters I had with young people. I've found some champions. Going to Daring School wasn't just the key to the city. I found there is a school here in Maine where 30 home languages are accommodated under one roof, and there's respect for all cultures. I found children who pride themselves in dedicating a day in their lives to package meals that are given to suffering communities outside the United States. I went to Wainfleet School, where I engaged with champions who wanted to know, who are already positioning themselves for leadership in the world, not just in the country. And they want to know what is the difference. And they embrace the fact that we are a global community and we can learn from each other. I went to the Mitchell Institute, and I'll tell my father, Majele, that you can be Mr. Mitchell. You're already giving. Let's document. You can give to your community and you can grow your community. I went to Tree Street. I'll urge you all to get there. That was a life-changing experience, to see children from all walks of life walk together hand in hand, share their life experiences, but then get back and say, can I be like you? I want to be like you. I have learned a lot, and I've been touched by the community. Speaking at Bates College in a room full of students who want to understand the global challenge, I can only say we are going to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. They say no to poverty, no to hunger, yes to education, yes to climate solutions, but more important, international partnerships are a must. Let me end by paying tribute. This is about women. I shared with other women that my woman mentors tell me, in hell, there's a place where women who don't love other women will burn and burn and burn and burn. Justice for Women, Kathy Lee, you are not going to burn. Thank you so much. I am not done yet. Dean Conway, you're not going to burn. It's all about women. Thank you.
We now have time for some questions. There is a mic in this aisle and a mic in that aisle, and you can line up and present your questions, and Dr. Sibanda will respond.
I want to first start off by saying, does this go up? Doesn't matter. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your vast knowledge with us. It's really an honor to have you in the state. Thank you. I wanted to hear a little bit more about how climate change affects food insecurity and your organization's view on the issue of climate change.
We've got a slogan, actually two. Climate change is real. Yeah? And when the choir sings, "They are the world," nothing about climate change without the youth, because it's your generation that will have to face the consequences. It's real now, particularly for us in Africa, because what it has done already is that we are experiencing erratic rainfalls. We are experiencing more frequent droughts. We are experiencing things that never used to happen. And I'll give you the example of just temperature. We feel that we used to go to plant every year without fail in Zimbabwe in November. 11 November was planting season. If you haven't brought your inputs by October, forget it. You won't find them in the market. But now, as I speak this year, the farmers went to plant last week. That's when the rains, the proper rains that guarantee a return. But we know that frost is going to bite in 2 months' time. So this year, disaster year. But this drought cannot be what we call climate change. It's about changes in climate over a longer period, both in temperature and in rainfall. And one thing that science tells us is that come year 2030, we're going to experience at least 30% to 60% decline in the cereals that we depend on. The research my organization has done, we've tried to download our global climate models to predict what will happen in 2050. The question we asked is, the places where we are growing our corn, will they still be viable? And most of those are going to be hot spots. We are not going to get anything. We better move to millet and sorghum fast. Next question is, what type of farmer will survive in those conditions? We need new technologies. So what we say at FANPAN, adapt now, but adapt in a responsible way, where you're reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases from agriculture. Agriculture is predicted to emit up to 30% of the world's global greenhouse gases. But we can mitigate if we have the right technologies. And that's what we need to invest our monies for research on. That's why we need finance for our farmers to be able to access those technologies. And we also need to provide training because we need a new way of doing business. We need climate smart agriculture now. That's why for the United Nations negotiations, FANPAN says, no agriculture, no deal.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your wonderful talk. I was wondering if you would address for a moment the tensions that I've seen here in Maine and in other development work that I have done between entrepreneurship and not-for-profit work. So there was a statistic that you missed. There are more not-for-profits in Maine per capita than any other state in the union. And there is a limited pile of funding. And I've noticed that the funding either goes to the farmers or it goes to the not-for-profits. And it's not that those need to be in competition, but how do we develop entrepreneurship models so that farmers can farm effectively? And how do we bring entrepreneurship, considering the tensions that we have, in the not-for-profit development model?
It's a burning question in the South, where I come from. I love your smile. It's a question globally. And what I like about the Sustainable Development Goals is that goal number 17 talks about partnerships. No one can do it alone. We need each other. And there's a big slogan, no one must be left behind between now and 2030. We are in it together. Now, for profit, the million-dollar question to every farmer is, why are you farming? You can't produce everything on your farm that you need. There are bills that will have to be paid. And what we always say is the farmer's first priority is to feed their family, to feed the fiscus, and to feed the soil. And all those in an era of sustainable development goals have to be met, because otherwise there will be no balance. Now, when you're looking at for-profit and not-for-profit, I think we all need to be social entrepreneurs. There's something that you must give for nothing, but there's something that you must earn so that you stay alive. So we need to cut a balance. But we can't all do things for not profit, and we can't all be extractive. The biggest dilemma now is the discussion on seeds. My grandparents used to select their seed, preserve what is good, and take it back to the land. We wanted more yield, so we invested in hybrid seed. And it meant that to go to the land, you need to buy the seed. Now, the challenge we have in Africa is that this is a $4 billion industry that is led by multinationals. What that means is that those who want to replicate the seed cannot even penetrate that industry. And as policy advisors, we say that's not fair. Surely something is wrong. Access is key for food security, as Dean Conway said. So we need to change the game. We need new rules for that game, which will allow access. And that's where you start breaking the commercial model to not-for-profit, because these farmers are farming for subsistence, first and foremost, but they also need that extra income so that they can buy what they don't produce. So surely you have to meet them halfway. And that's where I think you need the dialogue platforms to say, no policy is win-win for all, but can we have leaders who realize that there's got to be equity, there's got to be fair play, but there are basic justice issues that have to be respected, and that's where you draw the line. That would be my take, yeah.
Hi, thank you so much. I just have a question. I'm not an expert in the field at all, but I do wonder if you have a stance on the role, if any, of GMOs in the, you know, development of a sustainable agriculture and a hunger-free world.
Yeah. I'm glad I gave the example of seeds, because that's the burning issue. Which type of seed? I spoke about my grandmother who had her own backyard selected. We moved to hybrids. My own country, Zimbabwe, is one that had 90% coverage. Farmers that had taken up hybrid seed and productivity went up. On GMO, we are saying there are rules of the game. As an organization, we say, avail the knowledge, and that's why we upload information on GMO on our website, but make sure there's scientific evidence to back up a position, and most important, make sure biosafety principles and protocols are in place to protect the people. Safety first, affordability, and nutrient-dense food. Yeah. Now, the examples. We've got South Africa. That's one country as far back as 97. They fully embrace GMOs. And as I speak now, 90% of the white and yellow corn grown in South Africa is BT. We call it BT maize. Burkina Faso is an interesting case. That's one country that said yes in 2011. Close to 70% of the cotton, not the food crops that they grew, was BT cotton. But what was interesting is that the farmers realized that of the 30% in 2012 that hadn't used BT cotton, the yields were higher. So they were misinformed in what was in it for them, and they dumped it. But as a country, they are still pro-GMO. So we are saying, avail the information, allow the policymakers to know, make sure there is biosafety protocols in place, but let those farmers who want the choice and they have the right enactments in their legislation that allows them to do it, do it. But make sure people know what they are buying.
Hi.
I thought you were going to sing.
Oh, I need my chorus for that. I love your outfit, by the way. Absolutely gorgeous. And you're inspiring. I'm so happy you're here. It's really great to see African women do what you're doing. My question is, I'm a little short, okay. You talked a little bit about how clearly it's important that youth should get involved. I heard in your story, well, just in reality, most young people want to go into the city and, you know, work in business, become a lawyer or whatnot. I guess I want to know, what is your organization doing to incorporate the importance of farming in the primary education in Zimbabwe?
Great question. My dad would just embrace you and say, you know what? Hard work don't kill anybody, and the first laboratory is the farm. It's sad, we used to have agriculture as part of primary school education and as a subject, they still have it in high school, where you write your high school certification when you opt for agriculture. But we used to have it previously as compulsory education, primary education. But what this has done is that the kids at school have turned away from it because the teachers started using it as punishment. If there's a plot that needed weeding and you were not in class, you were sent to the agriculture class. So, and because we use the hand hoe and you're out in the sun without a sun hat, no water at times, kids say, I'm not getting out here. And because our farming has resulted in poor farmers because we have not invested in the tools they need for good farming, no kid wants to go in there. But it's changing now as we modernize our agriculture, ensure that people with college degrees now want to farm. They're now saying, okay, if they're making money, then I can go in there. But we're saying we need to bring dignity to the profession of farmers. These are people who feed us. So the minimum we can do with our policies is to create a conducive environment for farming. What does that take? Make sure they are farming in the right places where they've got the natural resource base, the water and the good land. Make sure they have access to input and credit that will allow them to get the right technologies for farming, but create markets as well. Free markets that will allow farmers to access their inputs and give them an incentive for safeguarding the environment. Because for as long as they plow in and protect the soil and no one benefits or gives them any reward for that, they will be extractive and will end up with denuded soils that don't give back to our crops. So we are saying bring dignity to the business of farming. Then young people like you will be proud farmers that will feed Africa and the world. And I strongly believe Africa can feed the world if our policies are right.
Well, thank you, Maine Law, and Kathy Lee, and Dr. Linda Way. And the one thing I learned about justice for women is the big idea is that afterwards, that people would be stimulated with new ideas to attack whatever it is that was brought to us. And so hunger has been around Maine and around the world forever, and I appreciate that you identified it. It is poverty. And Maine legislators and Maine city government and state government have been informed, they're educated, and they know the statistics and the data. They know that the hunger problem is poverty. Mm-hmm. It's not new to them. However, there hasn't been much change other than finding out how to get food through a food pantry and so forth. And I'm even told that some parties are afraid to talk about that. And, you know, at one point women couldn't vote and men were afraid of it, but we kept it up and we ended up voting. So we still have to do the right thing regardless of what party is afraid of doing something different. But we talk about the 1 in 4 children, and I'll just say this, that 1 in 4 child that's hungry is attached to an adult. That 1 in 4 child and that adult are living in poverty. So if no one wants to do anything to help that adult, can we start, and shouldn't we start, and aren't you curious, what can we do for that one child? Okay, so that means we have to start teaching our children really early. From kindergarten up, what is poverty? Why is it here? How does it affect you, and how do you affect it? And how can you avoid it? That's just a comment, it's not a question. It says, I care about those kids. I care about my friends' kids that grew up in poverty and still in poverty, and now they're going to get the food box and having children, and those children are going to go get the food box. So we're going to foster that 1 in 4 child by giving them food boxes so they can grow up knowing that's the answer. So eventually they carry the food box for their mom, and then eventually they go get their own food box. That generational poverty, I just wanted to mention that. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
You've just heard Dr. Lindiwe Majele-Sabanda here on Speaking in Maine. The lengthy Q&A section was shortened for broadcast. However, you can find the rest of the Q&A section, along with this program and others like it, archived on our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for audio on demand. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.